There were feet moving behind closed doors, and old floorboards creaked overhead. Shug put his hand lightly over her mouth.
Shh! Be quiet, will you? You'll wake up every soul in the place.
Agnes pushed his arm away from her face, threw her arm wide, and sang louder. Show me the stairway I have to climb. Lights came on in one of the rooms. Shug could see it from under the thin door. He put his hands under her arms and tried to pick her up, drag her up the carpeted stairs. The more he pulled, the more easily she slid through his hands, like a boneless bag of flesh. Each time he got leverage, she would become formless and slip free. Agnes spilt back onto the stairs with a giggle and went on singing to herself. An Englishman in one of the rented rooms hissed through his closed door,
Keep it down before I call the police. People are trying to sleep.
To Shug, he sounded like a small, effeminate man, the way he dribbled out his sibilant S's. Shug would have liked him to open the door. Shug would have liked to leave a sovereign print on his face. Agnes feigned a front.
Aye, phone the police, you spoil sport. I'm on my holiday.
Shug clamped his hand tight over her wet mouth. She only giggled. With mischief in her eyes, she licked the inside of his palm with a fat tongue. It felt like a warm, wet slab of flank mutton. It turned his stomach. Tightening his grip, he dug his ringed fingers into her cheeks till he forced her dentures apart. The smile left her eyes. Leaning his face close to hers, he hissed,
I'm only going to tell you this the once. Pick yourself up. Get yourself up these stairs.
Slowly, he took his hand away from her face. There was a pink mark where he had squeezed her jaw. There was fear in her eyes, and she looked almost sober again. As he drew his hand away, the fear melted from her eyes, and the demon drink came back into her face. She spat at him through the ceramic teeth.
Who the fuck do you think?
Shug was on her before she could finish. Stepping over her, he reached backwards into her hair. The hardened hairspray cracked like chicken bones as he wound his fingers into the strands. With a tug hard enough to rip handfuls out by the roots, he started up the stairs, dragging her behind him. Agnes's legs splayed awkwardly. She flailed like a clumsy spider as she tried to find her footing. The ripping pain stung her skull, and she wrapped her hands around his arm for purchase. Shug barely felt the sharpness of her nails as she pierced his skin. He pulled her up a stair, then he pulled her up another, and then another. The dirty carpet burnt her back, rubbed the skin from her neck, ripped the paillettes from her shiny dress. Hooking his thick arm under her chin, he dragged her across the next carpeted landing. In one motion, he dropped her at the door, fished out the key, turned on the bare light, and dragged her inside. Agnes lay abandoned behind the door like a ragged draft excluder. The beaded dress had worked itself up her white legs. Her hand reached to her head, feeling for where her hair had started to tear. Shug crossed the room and pulled her hand away, suddenly embarrassed at what he had done.
Stop touching it yourself. I've no hurt you.
She could feel the blood of her scalp and her fingers. Her ears were ringing from the bump, thump, bump of each stair. The numbness of the drink was leaving her.
Why did you do that?
You were making a show of me.
Shug took off his black suit jacket and laid it over the single wooden chair. He took off the black tie and wound it neatly upon itself. His face was flushed red and had made his eyes look somehow smaller and darker. While he dragged her upstairs, his hair had come undone from the bald patch he tried hard to conceal. The loosened strands hung by his left ear, thin and ratty looking. There was a cluck in the back of his throat, like a switch firing. And then his hands were on her again. She felt the claw on her neck, felt it on her thigh. He used his fingers and dug into her softness, wanting to be sure he had a firm grip. As flesh separated from bone, She cried out from the pain, and he hammered his sovereign ring twice into her cheek. When she was quiet again, Shug bent over and dug his nails into her shoulder and thigh and threw her onto the rented bed like a burst bin bag. He climbed on top of her. His face was a blazing shade of scarlet, his limp hair swinging free from his swollen head. It was as though he was filling with boiling blood. Using his elbows, he pushed all his weight onto her arms, shoved them into the mattress until they felt like they might snap. He took the bulk of himself, all the driving weight he had gained from being so sedentary, and pushed it into her and pinned her there below him. With his right hand, he reached below her dress and found the soft white parts of her. She crossed her legs below him. He felt the ankles lock one over the other. With his free hand, he gripped her thighs and tried to pull the dead weight of them apart. There was no giving. The lock was tight. He dug his fingers into the soft tops of her legs, digging the nails in until he felt the skin burst, until he felt her ankles open. He pushed into her as she wept. There was no drink in her now. There was no fight in her anymore. When he was done, he put his face against her neck. He told her he would take her dancing in the lights again tomorrow. Chapter 3. That summer, when it finally came, was close and damp. For a nocturnal man, the days had felt too long. The long daylight was like an inconsiderate guest, the northern gloom reluctant to leave. Big Shug always found the summer days hardest to sleep through. The sun brightened the thick curtains till they were a vibrating violet, and the children were always noisiest when they were happiest. The door going constantly with mouthy teenagers from other flats and women in strappy sandals traipsing the hall carpet, clacking pink feet and pink gums at all hours. As night finally fell, Big Shug pulled his black hackney round in a small, tight circle. It spun like a fat dog chasing its tail and headed out of the Sighthill estate. Seeing the lights of Glasgow, he relaxed back into the seat, and for the first time that day, his shoulders fell from around his ears. For the next 8 hours, the city was his, and he had plans for it. He wiped the window and got a good look in the wing mirror. Smiling to himself, he thought how smashing he looked. White shirt, black suit, black tie. It was a bit much for work, Agnes had said. But then she said altogether too much these days. As the smile travelled through his body, he wondered whether taxi driving was in his blood. Between him and his brother Rascal, it was practically a family business. His father would have enjoyed it too, had the shipbuilding not killed him. Shug pulled up at the lights under the shadow of the Royal Infirmary and watched a gaggle of nurses smoke a crafty fag. He watched them rub their pink arms in the cold night air and shelf their tits over tight-folded arms. They smoked without using their hands, afraid of losing any body heat. He smiled slowly and watched himself react in the mirror. Night shift definitely suited him best. He liked to roam alone in the darkness, getting a good look at the underbelly. Out came the characters shellacked by the grey city, years of drink and rain and hope holding them in place. His living was made by moving people, but his favourite pastime was watching them. The thin driver's window made a sharp slicing sound as he slid it down and lit a cigarette. The wind came rushing in, and his long strands of thin hair danced like beach grass in the breeze. He hated going bald, hated getting old. It made everything hard work. He adjusted the mirror lower so that he couldn't see the reflection of his bare head. He found his long, thick moustache and sat absent-mindedly stroking it, like a favourite pet. Under it, his spare chin wobbled. He tilted the mirror back up. The Glasgow streets were shiny with rain and streetlights. The infirmary nurses didn't linger, flicking half-smoked fags into the puddles and tottering back inside. Shug sighed and turned the taxi past town ahead and pointed down towards the city centre. He liked the drive from Sighthill. It was like a descent into the heart of the Victorian darkness. The closer you got to the river, the lowest part of the city, the more the real Glasgow opened up to you. There were hidden nightclubs tucked under shadowy railway arches and blacked-out windowless pubs where old men and women sat on sunny days in a sweaty, pungent purgatory. It was down near the river that the skinny, nervous-faced women sold themselves to men in polished estate cars. And sometimes it was here that the police would later find chopped-up bits of them in black bin bags. The north bank of the Clyde housed the city mortuary, and it seemed fitting that all the lost souls were floating in that direction, so as to be no trouble when their time, blessedly, came. Pulling past the station, Shug was glad the rank there was full of taxis and empty of punters. Tourists were dull, talkative, and fucking cheap. They'd be an eternity lugging massive cases into the back, and then would sit there steaming up the taxi in squeaky packamacks. Those ugly tight-arse bastards could shove their 10 pence tips. He gave a snide toot to the boys and drove on lower towards the river. Rain was a natural state of Glasgow. It kept the grass green and the people pale and bronchial. Its effect on the taxi business was negligible. It was a problem because it was mostly inescapable, and the constant dampness was pervasive. So fares might as well sit damp on a bus as damp in the back of an expensive taxi. On the other hand, rain meant that the young lassies from the dancing all wanted to take a taxi home, so as not to ruin their stiff hair or their sharp shoes. For that, Shug was in favour of the endless rain. He pulled up Hope Street and sat at the rank. It shouldn't be long. Only two or three of the old boys were sat there, waiting for a hire. From here, it was a short stoat from the dancing on Socky Hall Street, or a frozen trot for the working girls pitched out in Blythewood Square. Either way, it was a good spot for an interesting night. Shug sat smoking in the dreich and listened to the crackle of the CB radio. The lady dispatcher announced fares up in Postle and runs to be had down in the Trongate. Joni Micklewhite was the only voice on the radio, and every night he listened to her hold this repetitive circular monologue, asking for help, waiting for answers, giving orders, and bluffing any back chat. Always only half a conversation, like she was talking to herself, or talking, it seemed, only to him. He liked the peaceful sound of her voice. He took a comfort from it. He finished his cigarette and watched young couples huddle together as they left the late picture. The drivers in front slowly started to pull fares and rattle off into the night. Alone at the head of the rank, he watched a group of young lassies dribble chips onto the street as they had a fight over how they should get home. It looked like they'd get in the taxi. But no, the fat practical one wanted to wait for the night bus. Leave her, he thought. Let her get wet. The prettiest, most gutted one was still stumbling towards him. Shug practiced his smile in the half-light. He was dragged from his dirty thoughts as a set of bony knuckles rapped on the window.
If I hire, pal, said a man's voice.
No,
shouted Shug, pointing in the direction of the wrecked girls.
Right then,
said the old man, not paying any heed. He opened the door before Shug could hit the automatic lock and pulled his small frame and voluminous coats inside.
Do you ken the Rangers Bar on Jig Street?
Shug sighed.
Aye, pal.
As the pretty girl slid along the queue to the taxi behind his. He gave her a half smile, but she paid him no mind. Ignoring the black leather seat that ran the width of the taxi, the old man pulled down a folding seat and sat directly behind Shug. This was the sign of a talker, Here we fucking go, thought Shug. It was wet outside, but humid inside the cab. The hackney filled with the smell of old milk. The old man sat in a yellowed shirt and a crumpled grey suit, over which he had piled a thin wool coat, and on top of this had added an oversized top coat. It gave him the look of a refugee, his tiny frame drowning in yards of Shetland wool and gabardine. On his head, he wore a Harris bonnet, from the shadows of which only his red round nose protruded. The patter started almost immediately.
"Did you see the game today, son?"
asked the milky passenger.
"No,"
answered Shug, already knowing where this was headed.
"Oh, you missed a great game. Bloody great game,"
the man was tutting to himself.
"Who do you support then?"
"Celtic," he lied. He was no Catholic, but it was the shortcut to ending the conversation. The old man's face crumpled like a dropped till.
"Oh, for fuck's sake. Might have known I'd get in a babe's taxi."
Shug watched him in the mirror and snorted under his moustache. He didn't support Celtic. He didn't support the Rangers either. But he was proud to be a Protestant. He would have turned his Masonic ring around, but the old man was paying no heed and moving like he was underwater. Bemused, Shug watched as the man worked himself up into a state of distracted despair, swinging from lachrymose to belligerent. He held his hands in front of him like he was pleading with God. Then he laid his arm across the back of the partition and brought his face inches from the glass separating him from Shug's ear. Wet-lipped with the drink, he was spitting out random streams of patter, making faces like a toddler learning to talk. Big globs of wet spit misted the partition. Shug deliberately tapped the brakes, and the man's forehead made a thunk sound as it skelped off the glass. Bonnetless but undeterred, he kept on with his rambling. Shug frowned. He'd have to give that a good wipe later. The old Glasgow JK was a dying breed. A traditionally benign soul that was devolving into something younger and far more sinister with the spread of drugs across the city. Shug looked in the mirror and watched the man continue his drunken solo, the conversation so low and incoherent that he could pick out only certain words like
Thatcher
and
Union
and
Bastard.
With no feelings of sympathy, he watched as the man laughed and then sobbed at intervals. The Loudon Tavern sat dark and windowless, the door well recessed into the brick face of the low building. It was by design rock-proof, bottle-proof and bomb-proof. The facade, painted with the red, white and blue of the Glasgow Rangers, was gloriously defiant in the shadow of Parkhead, the home of Glasgow Celtic, the sporting mecca of all Catholics. Shug told the man the fare was £1.70, and watched him ferret in one pocket after another. All the Glasgow Jakeys did this. Their Friday wages were splintered by every bar they passed till they rolled around in pockets, as 5 and 10 pence in change, the cumulative weight of the heavy small coins giving them a waddling walk and a hump. They would live on the coins for the rest of the week, taking their chances with their random findings. Even in sleep, they were never to be separated from their trousers and large coats for fear their wives or children would tip them out first and buy bread and milk with the shrapnel. The man was an age looking in every pocket. Shug listened to the soft voice on the CB and tried to stay calm. By the time the Jakey had paid and sailed into the dark mouth of the pub, Shug was thundering back along Duke Street, trying not to miss the dancing letting out. Outside the Scala, an old deer stuck her hand out, waving it like a small bird. Shug had to stop short or run her over. He watched her climb into the back of the taxi and felt relieved when she sat square in the centre of the wide black seat.
"The parade, please,"
she sniffed, wrinkled her nose, and looked scornfully at Shug. It must have smelled like someone pissed in a pot of old porridge back there. The taxis started climbing the tenemented hills of Deniston. Shug looked in the mirror and watched the woman, who was watching him. The Glasgow housewives always sat square in the middle, never to the side looking out of the window or on one of the fold-down seats like the lonely old men who were hungry for company. She sat as they all did, upright and rigid, like a Presbyterian queen, knees together, back straight, with her hands clasped on her lap. Her coat was pulled close around herself. Her hair was set and brushed, even in the back, and her face was set tight like a mask.
"It's a wild, terrible night, right enough," she said finally.
"Aye. The radio said it would piss all week."
There was something about the woman that reminded him of his own mother, dead and gone. The raw hands and tiny frame belied the strength and power that surely ran through her. He thought of the nights his father would raise his fist on his mother. The more she took it, the more he rained down on her, turning her red, then blue, then black. Chug thought about her at the mirror, pulling her hair over her face, pushing her makeup wider around her eyes to cover the bruises.
"I was just saying, I don't usually get a taxi."
She was searching for his eyes in the mirror.
"Oh, aye,"
said Shug, glad to have his thoughts interrupted.
"Aye, but I've had a wee win the night, you see. Just a wee one, mind. It's nice all the same."
She was rubbing her thumbnail raw.
"All coming right handy, you see. Now the mad George is out of work,"
she sighed.
25 years. Out of the Dalmarnock Ironworks. And all he got was 3 weeks' wages. 3 weeks. I went up there myself, chapped on the big red gaffer's door, and I tell him what he could do with 3 weeks' wages.
She opened the clasp in her small handbag and looked inside.
"Do you know what that big bastard tell me? Mrs. Brodie, your husband was lucky to get 3 weeks. I have some young boys with their whole lives ahead of them and they only got paid till the end of their shift." Made my blood absolutely boil, so it did. I said to him, "Well, I've got 2 grown boys at home to feed and they can't find any work either. So just what do you suppose I do about that?" He looked at me and he didn't even blink when he said, "Try South Africa."
She closed the bag.
"They've never even been to South Lanarkshire. Never mind South Africa."
She kept rubbing her red thumb.
"It's no right. The government should do something. Shutting down the ironworks and shipbuilding. It'll be the miners next, just you watch. South Africa. I never. Go all the way to South Africa so they can build cheap boats there and send them home to put more of our boys out of work. The shower of swine."
"It's diamonds," Shug offered. "They go to South Africa to mine diamonds."
The woman looked as if he had contradicted her.
"Well, I don't care what they mine. They could be pulling licorice out of a black man's arse for all I care. But they should be working here at home in Glasgow and eating their mammy's cooking."
Shug put his foot on the accelerator. The city was changing. He could see it in people's faces. Glasgow was losing its purpose, and he could see it all clearly from behind the glass. He could feel it in his takings. He had heard them say that Thatcher didn't want honest workers anymore. Her future was technology and nuclear power and private health. Industrial days were over, and the bones of the Clyde shipworks and the Springburn railworks lay about the city like rotted dinosaurs. Whole housing estates of young men who had promised the working trades of their fathers had no future now. Men were losing their very masculinity. Shug had watched the thinning out of the working classes from their poor neighbourhoods. Middle-class civil servants and city planners had seen it a stroke of genius to ring the city with new towns and cheaply built estates. Given a patch of grass and a view of the sky, the city's ills were supposed to disappear. The woman sat stiff and still on the back seat. The skin was wearing off around her thumbs, and worry sat around the corners of her mouth. Only when she patted the back of her hair did Shug know she was still alive. The taxi dropped her at the mouth of her close.
and she pushed a pound tip into Shug's hand.
Here, what's this?
He tried to pass it back.
I'm no needing that.
Here's peace,
she shushed.
It's just a wee bit of my winnings. I'm spreading my luck around. Luck's the only thing that's going to get us out of this mess.
Shug took the tip reluctantly. Fuck the English tourists and their bastard in Kodaks. Shug had seen it before. Those with least to give always gave the most. By the time Shug got back to the city centre, the last picture had let out, and the city was settling in for a few hours of cold sleep. Some of the late-night clubs were banging out music, but it was suicide to sit outside them waiting for a fare because the first drunks wouldn't be spilling out till well after midnight. Shug sighed and thought about waiting around. Maybe he'd pick up a bird who'd been left holding all the baby sham while our pals danced with some fellas. The ugliest bird usually left first. He'd driven them home before. Even waited with the meter off while they got some consoling bags of crisps and chocolate biscuits from the corner packy. If you talked nice to them, they were dead nice back. He had loosened his tie and settled in for the long wait when the soft voice came over the radio.
Car 31, car 31, come in.
His heart sank. It was Agnes. It had to be. He picked up the black receiver and pressed the button on the side.
Car 31 here.
There was a long pause, and he waited for the news.
You've been requested up at Stobhill. Car for Easton, said Joni Micklewhite.
I've got a fare, and I'm taking them out to the airport. Do you know of a car closer? He asked.
Sorry, Sunshine. You've been specially requested.
He could almost hear the smile.
Punter said to take your time. There was no rush.
He hadn't thought it'd be this. Agnes, surely. Or even his first wife, after money for their four wains. But he hadn't thought it would be this. They weren't there yet, surely. The drive up to the old hospital was quick this time of night. The Royal Infirmary was where the football stabbings and Gyro Day domestics went. Stob Hill was where Glasgow was born and where Glasgow died. Now a mousy girl was stood there in the glow from the foyer, wearing a blue cleaner's apron. She clawed at her saggy tights and wriggled them straight and flat. Her makeup had spread from the cold and the tears, and he could see the ring of burnt doubts at her feet, like she must have been waiting in the cold for him her whole break. Shug smiled. She was only 24, and already his doormat.
I didn't think you were coming,
she said, climbing into the back of the taxi.
What did you call me out here for?
I missed you, that's all, she said. I haven't seen you in weeks.
She rolled her thick legs open and shut coquettishly.
You've no gun off of me, have you?
She grinned. Shug turned in his seat.
Who the fuck do you think you are, Anne-Marie? I'm trying to make a living, and you call me across the city like I was a dog that pissed in your carpet.
He slammed the heel of his fist on the glass partition.
We have to be discreet, cool-like. What the fuck do you think would happen if Agnes found out, eh? I'll tell you what would happen. She'd get a hold of you by the scruff of your neck and drag the length of the Clyde with you for starters. When she was done dragging your body, she would drag your good name. She'd phone your parents every night just after they'd gone to their beds. She'd wake them up and tell them that their good wee Catholic girl was carrying on with a married man.
He paused, watching his words take effect.
Is that really what you want?
The tears were running down her face and pulling on her apron.
But I love you.
Shug pulled the taxi in a sharp arc and parked in a dark corner of the empty car park. He glanced at his watch and then met her gaze again in the mirror.
I will. Take your fucking knickers off then. I've only got 5 minutes.
Shug felt hungry as he headed back into the city. He was certain Anne-Marie wouldn't call the rank for him for a while. She was a nice lassie. Heavy tits and eager too. But she was cramping his style. That was the problem with the young ones. They saw no reason to not expect better for themselves. She'd definitely have to go.
He was just thinking of the voice on the radio when it spoke to him again.
Car 31, car 31, come in.
He picked up the receiver and held his breath. He was running out of luck. Joni.
Phone home now,
came the terse reply. He pulled the hackney over at the mouth of Gordon Street, and clipping coins out of his dispenser, he made a quick dash through the rain to an old red phone box. It was wet on the inside and smelled like piss. He had tried ignoring Agnes's orders before, but that just made things more difficult. She would be insistent and get more abusive as the night wore on. The best thing to do was phone home now. It barely rang once before it was answered. She would have been sat at the pleather phone table in the hall, just drinking and waiting and drinking.
Hello?
Said the voice. Agnes, what is it?
Well, if it isn't the Chief Whoremaster himself.
Agnes, Shug sighed. What is it this time?
I know,
spat the drunken voice.
Know what?
Know everything.
You're no making any sense.
He shifted uncomfortably in the tight phone box.
I know!
The voice boomed, her wet lips too close to the mouthpiece.
If you're going to keep this up, I'm going to have to get back to work.
There was a deep sob on the end of the phone.
Agnes, you can't phone the rank anymore. I'll get the sack. I'll be home in a few hours and we can talk then, okay?
But there was no answer.
Well, do you want to know what I know? I know I love you.
He lied. The sobbing got louder. Shug hung up. The rain and piss had soaked through his tasselled brogues. Picking up the black receiver again, he hammered it against the side of the red booth. He knocked out three panes of glass before the receiver broke, before he felt better. Back in the taxi, he had to sit still for 10 minutes until his knuckles would let go of the choke they had on the steering wheel. Maybe he would feel better if he ate something. He fished around under his seat for his plastic peace box. It smelled like margarine and white bread, like marriage and cramped flats. The corned beef pieces Agnes had packed turned his stomach. He dumped them into the gutter and cut up several side streets till he pulled up in front of DiRollo's Chippy, open 24 hours, bog standard. DiRollo's was popular with both cabbies and prostitutes because of the unsociable hours and the discretion of its owner. There was a big red lobster painted on the sign, but nothing as exotic on offer inside. Joe DiRollo stood behind the counter, as he seemed to do every hour of the day. At night, the fluorescent light made him look deceased. A small man, hair thin and slicked back off his face, with chip grease or brill cream or both. Like an oily iceberg, only his swollen head and shoulders were visible above the counter. The rest of his sallow bulk was squished up against the machete he kept under the counter. He greeted everyone with a phlegmy clearing of the throat and tilting of his fat head.
"How you doing, Joe?"
asked Shug, with no genuine interest.
"Aye, no so bad.
Been busy with our fair ladies tonight."
Shug shoved his thumb in the direction of a gaunt-looking customer who, eyes closed, was swaying on her feet.
"Aye, they've been a-coming and a-going, you know."
He laughed at his own joke.
"No so good for business anymore. They eat half a bag of chips, drink a ginger, that's it. They asked to use a toilet, my own toilet, and old Joe says, okay. He's a nice guy, but they don't come out for an hour, you know. They eat a half a bag of chips, and then they wash their cunts in my toilet."
Shug was eyeing the fried fish in the hot counter.
"That's the drugs. I wouldn't dare stick it in them anymore."
"Aye, they're dropping like flies. If the drugs are not doing them in, then some bad bastard's choking the life out of them."
"You'll put me off my whelks," Shug pulled a tight face.
Give's a fish supper, extra salt and vinegar, would you?
Joe took the white paper and dropped a heaped scoop of fat chips and a big bit of golden battered fish on it. He drizzled the hot food with salt and vinegar, and Shug circled with his fingers.
Mayor, Joe, mayor.
The man piled it on till it was sodden. He handed Shug his parcel.
So? You never give me an answer to my offer. You want the wee house or no?
As well as running the chippy, Joe Di Rolo was famous for grifting the Glasgow City Council. He signed up for subsidised flats under the guise of one of his many daughters. Then he rented them along, skimming an extra tenner a week over what the council originally charged him.
I'll let you know,
Shug said, backing out the door.
Mrs. Bain? Well, she's difficult.
I'm surprised you want to move at all. Thought you would be living like a king up there in that Sight Hill sky.
The king is fine. It's the queen that wants a beheading. Just hold on to that empty house of yours a while longer. There's a lot that has to be lined up first. I want it all to go perfect.
He smiled and bit into a fat chip. By the time Shug finished the last of the whelks, there was only an hour or so left on the clock. He rolled down the windows as the sun broke the top of George Square, bathing the city in a warm orange light and setting the statue of Rabbi Burns on fire. It was the best time of day, the city at peace before it got ruined by the diurnal masses. He watched the clock in anticipation and set off early for the north side, driving slowly all the way to Joni Micklewhite. He left the windows down and flicked the green air freshener with his forefinger. She would finish her shift soon, and then they could say all the things they could not over the CB radio. He pulled the taxi in tight amongst four or five others and waited for her, slumped forward in his seat, grinning like a daft boy, watching the front door like it was Christmas. Chapter 4. They were both still damp and sitting on the edge of the bed when the evening streetlights came on. Agnes had run Shuggy a deep bath, and then, feeling lonely, she'd climbed in beside her youngest. Lizzie would have had a fit if she had seen. It would have to stop soon. He was too canny for five. It was the first time he'd looked at her privates and then considered his own, like a spot-the-difference puzzle. The water had grown cold as they made a great game of filling the shampoo bottles and then soaking each other with the soapy jet. She let him scrape at the old nail polish on her toes, his care and attention feeling like a penny dropped in an empty meter. At the edge of her bed, she combed the boy's glossy black hair as his head lowered in concentration. He made the matchbox car squeal through the paisley maze of bedspread. It climbed over her bare leg as easily as the Campsie Hills. Without knowing what he was looking at, he traced the white scars, the memories of Shug's fingernails, that lined the inside of her thigh. Then the car careened back to the bedspread. The tires would scream loudly, and the boy would look up at her and smile with the self-satisfied face of his father. Agnes drew a fresh can of lager from a hidden place and gently pulled at the ring top. With a careful finger, she gathered the bubbly drips and popped them into her mouth. She gave the boy the empty tenant's can. He had always liked the half-naked beauties photographed on the site. Shuggy was intent on this one. He hadn't seen her before, and he liked the way her name sounded when he spelt it out slowly, just like his granda Willie had taught him. Sh-he-na. Shuggy would collect the empty cans from around the house and line up the women on the edge of the bath. He would stroke their tinny hair and make them talk to each other in imagined conversations, rambling monologues, mostly about ordering new shoes from catalogues and whoring husbands. Big Shug had caught him once. He had watched proudly as Shuggy lined up the women and spelt out each of their names phonetically. He bragged about it later down the rank.
5 years old, eh? He would say. What a chip off the old block.
Agnes had looked on sadly, knowing what was really going on. Later that week, she took Shuggy into the BHS and bought him a baby doll. Daphne was a chubby little toddler with the tufted coif of a 50s housewife. Shuggy loved the doll. He put all his lager ladies in the bin after that. Shuggy had been watching his mother quietly. He was always watching. She had raised three of them in the same mould. Every single one of her children was as observant and wary as a prison warden.
"How's about some light entertainment?"
he asked, mimicking some nonsense from the telly. Agnes flinched. With her painted nails, she cupped his face and squeezed his dimples gently. She pushed until the boy's bottom lip protruded. "About," she corrected. "About." He liked the feeling of her hands on his face, and he cocked his head slightly and baited her. "About." Agnes frowned. She took her index finger and pushed it into his mouth, hooking his lower teeth. She gently pulled his jaw open and held it down. "There's no need to sink to their level, Hugh. Try it again." With her finger in his mouth, Shuggy pronounced it correctly, if not clearly. It had the round, proper "ow" sound that she liked. Agnes nodded her approval and let go of his lip.
"Does that mean the wee moose wisnae loose about the hoose?"
He was giggling before he could even finish the cheeky nonsense. Agnes hunkered down to chase him, and he squealed with happiness and terror as he raced around the bed. A pile of cassettes sat next to the alarm clock. He raked through them, scattering them to the floor until he landed on the one he was after. Shug had bought the alarm clock for her. He had saved bricks of petrol coupons, rubber banded together, and handed them to her like they were gold bullion. The plastic button released the cassette drawer. Shuggy punched the tape in and rewound it, screaming to the beginning. It sounded tinny and hollow on the alarm clock, but she didn't care. The music made the room feel less empty. Shuggy stood on the bed and put his arms on her shoulders. They swayed that way for a while. She kissed his nose. He kissed her nose. As the song changed, Shuggy watched his mother clutch the can to her chest and spin around the room. Agnes screwed her eyes shut and went back to a place where she felt young and hopeful and wanted. Back to the barland, where strange men would follow her hungrily across the ballroom and women would drop their eyes in jealousy. With fingers unfurling like a beautiful fan, she ran her hand over her body. Just above her hips, she touched the stubborn roll of fat she had earned from birthing her three wains. Suddenly, her eyes opened, and she returned from the past, feeling rotten and stupid and lumpy. "I hate this wallpaper. I hate those curtains and that bed and that fucking lamp." Shuggy rose to his stockinged feet on the soft bedspread. He wrapped his arms around her shoulders and tried to cling to her again, but this time she pushed him away. The small flat was never quiet. The walls were too thin. There was always the drone of the big telly turned up too loud for her father, the low complaints of Catherine with the telephone pulled into her bedroom, the cord saw-sawing the good veneer off the bottom of the door as she paced and moaned about the slights of being 17. There were neighbours on every side, and on the 16th floor, the wind, always the pulsing wind, rattling against the ill-fitted windows. Agnes put her head in her hands. She listened to her parents roar with laughter at some effeminate English comedian. Her eldest two were out, who knows where. They always seemed to be gone now, ducking her kisses, rolling their eyes at everything she said. She ignored Shuggy's light breathing, and for a moment, it was like she was not nearly 40, not a married woman with three children. She was Agnes Campbell again, stuck in her bedroom, listening to her parents through the wall.
"Dance for me," she said suddenly. "Let's have a wee party."
She stabbed at the alarm clock, and the cassette squealed forward, the slow, sad music speeding up to something happier. Shuggy lifted her lager can. He put it to his lips like it was a magical power juice. The bitter, oaty flavour made him flinch, the way it tasted like fizzy ginger, milk and porridge all at the same time. He danced for her, stepping side to side and clicking his fingers and missing every beat. When she laughed, he danced harder. He did whatever had caused her to laugh another dozen times till her smile stretched thin and false, and then he searched for the next move that would make her happy. He bounced and flung his arms out as she laughed and clapped. The happier she looked, the harder he wanted to spin and flail. The vibrating patterned wallpaper threatened to make him sick, but he kept going, punching the air and rattling his hips. Agnes threw her head back in peals of laughter, and the sadness was gone from her eyes. Shuggy snapped his fingers like a hard man and jutted his head, still missing the beat. It didn't matter. They were both breathless from laughing when they heard it. In the hallway, the front door opened and closed. It was more a sucking of wind and a contracting of space than a noise. Heavy footsteps came slowly up the carpet to the bedroom door. Agnes gathered the spent lager cans and hid them on the far side of the bed. She twisted the rings upright on her fingers and, turning expectantly to the door, she practiced her most light-hearted smile. The heavy footsteps stopped outside. Agnes and Shuggy listened to the soft chink-clink of small change in a trouser pocket. Then there was a low sigh, and the footsteps passed on down the hallway to the living room. He was home for his first tea break. It should have been a time to spend together. Now she listened to Shug say hello to her parents, his voice flat and without warmth. Agnes knew her father would have looked up, the television reflected on his glasses, and smiled. There would be a moment when Wally would have stood and offered Shug the comfy armchair. Both men would have circled it in an awkward game of musical chairs, until Shug put his hand on Wally's shoulder and lowered him back into the seat. Lizzie, stony-faced, would have stood to boil the kettle and shivered likely, as though it was not Shug, but the cold, campsy wind itself that had arrived. Agnes listened to it all through the wall. In a single sweep, she caught the creams and perfume bottles on her dresser and sent them across the room. The lamp lay broken on its side. The bare bulb glaring up at her changed her features so completely that it scared Shuggy. Everything had turned upside down so quickly. Agnes sank to the edge of the bed. Shuggy could feel her can of lager spill onto the mattress and start to soak through his socks. Burying her face in his hair, she sobbed her dry, frustrated tears. Her breath was clammy against his neck. Falling back on the bed, she pulled him down beside her. As she gripped him, he could see her face was lopsided. The paint on her eyes was blurred and running away. It looked like the lager beauties sometimes did, a careless printer and a misaligned screen, and suddenly the woman was no longer whole, just a mess of different layers. Agnes reached across the mattress for her cigarettes. She lit one, and sucking loudly, she coaxed the end into a blazing copper tip. She looked at the light for a moment, and her voice cracked with the poor me's as she sang along with the cassette. Her right arm extended gracefully, and she held the glowing cigarette against the curtains. Shuggy watched as the ash started to smoulder and then gave off a grey smoke. He started to squirm as the smoke burst with a gasp into orange flame. Agnes used her free arm and pulled him tighter towards her. "Shh, now be a big boy for your mammy." There was a dead calmness in her eyes. The room turned golden. The flames climbed the synthetic curtains and started rushing towards the ceiling. Dark smoke raced up, as though fleeing from the greedy fire. He would have been scared, but his mother seemed completely calm, and the room was never more beautiful as a light cast dancing shadows on the walls and the paisley wallpaper came alive like a thousand smoky fishes. Agnes clung to him, and together they watched all this new beauty in silence. The curtains were almost gone. They dripped like ice cream onto the carpet. Some of the wallpaper that had come loose around the damp window was alight, and the plastic curtain track melted in two and swung down like a broken bridge. A large bead of bubbling curtain landed on the corner of the bed, and the smoke grew around them. Shuggy started to squirm again. He couldn't stop coughing. A dark cough, sticky and bitter, like the time one of Lizzie's bingo pens had burst ink into his mouth. Agnes never moved. She just closed her eyes and sang her sad song. Big Shug stood framed in the darkness of the doorway. As fresh oxygen entered the room, the flames ran across the ceiling to greet him. He was on and over the bed and had the window open in an instant. With his bare hands, he pushed the burning polyester out the window. He picked the largest pieces of melted magma off the floor and threw them after the flaming fabric. Suddenly, he was gone again, and Shuggy cried out for his father, certain he had left them alone. When Shug returned, he was swinging wet bath towels. They sprayed sour water each time they found their mark, and the flames died under them. Shug turned to the bed and slapped the damp wet towels across the tangled bodies. Shuggy tried not to cry out as the whipping stung his skin. Agnes lay stiff, her eyes closed. When the last of the flames had died, Shug stood with his back to his wife and son. Through stinging eyes, Shuggy watched his father's shoulders shake with anger. And when he turned around, Shuggy could see that his face was flushed with the heat and his fingers were curled, scarlet and sore where he had burnt them. Lizzie and Wally stood in the darkness of the hallway. Shug ripped his son from under Agnes's arm and shunted him into Lizzie's embrace. Agnes lay still and lifeless on the bed, and when Shug pinched her face in his hand, his lips parted in an odd fish-like expression. Bending down, he shook her sharply and repeated her name over and over till the corners of his mouth were filled with spit. It was no use. He looked to Lizzie, who held the boy close. Willie ran his thick, calloused hand under his glasses, tears already running down his face. Shug looked down at his wife and her lifeless body. The room was silent. No one knew what to say. Agnes did not trust the quiet. She opened one of her eyes. Its pupil was dark and wide, but focused and clear. She put the mangled cigarette back between her lips.
Where the fuck have you been?
Chapter 5. The city centre was full of Orangemen. With their flutes, fife and drums, they had paraded from the Cenotaph in George Square through the city to Glasgow Green. From the office window, Catherine had watched the banners and sashes of the different lodges go by. At first, the Protestants sang their support of King Billy, and later, after the pubs had opened, they screamed, "Get up, you Fenian bastards!" To some tune, Catherine did not know, and doubted they did either. All day, policemen in reflective jackets sat on nervous horses. Now that the march was finished, young men gathered and sang sectarian songs like hateful carolers. They shouted at young girls that passed by and chased any man who wasn't wearing the correct colours. Catherine left the office as late as she possibly could, hoping to avoid the worst of it. She stood outside the sandstone building, deeply regretting her new emerald green coat and high-heeled suede boots. As rain clouds covered the July sun, she cursed having to work the orange Saturday. It wasn't like she was that great with numbers, but Mr. Cameron insisted she be there when he was, to answer the phones that never rang, to make the tea he never drank. It wasn't a bad first job, her stepfather Shug had argued.
especially for a daft lassie just out of school with her brain rotten on boys and clothes. Credit lending was boring, but she did like the way everything had to be neatly organised and squared away. She loved looking at the neat red pen at the bottom of each ledger page, tallied, undisputed and true. In a way, it was her inheritance from Agnes, this neat fastidiousness, this keen eye on what you had and what you could spend. It wasn't a bad job. And besides, Mr. Cameron had a son who was a big handsome sort. And as Catherine skulked home, she let herself think about the boy. Up at the cinema, Campbell Cameron had been all slithering hands, like a dirty octopus. Even his tenderest winching had felt entitled and demanding. Her granny had taken her aside once and told her that she was daft, that she should marry Seamus Kelly. Lizzie explained how she had married her good Catholic boy, and he had stood by her for over 40 years, through all sorts of problems. It was easy to ignore her granny's advice. After all, Lizzie had only had 2 new suttees in as long as Catherine could remember, and there had to be more to marriage than chapped hands and scullery knees. Lizzie needn't have worried about the young Cameron anyway. Catherine's stepfather was busy pushing his own nephew, Donald Jr., on her. When she had first seen her step-cousin, she had been secretly thrilled at the way he carried himself, how he made himself feel right at home in their small front room. Donald Jr. sat with his legs confidently open, taking more space than was his to take, and talking about himself with no modesty. She liked the subtle ways he let her know that he was more important than her. It was the way that proddy dogs always looked, like they were so loved, so well-fed, the centre of their own lives. They were their mother's pride, even in their shame or shortcomings, and Donald Jr. seemed entirely free from conscience or burden. He was golden, though in reality, he was more of a dewy, translucent pink. Catherine liked to watch him eat. She was scandalised by the way he preferred lamb meat dripping to cabbage soup, and the way he always expected 3 whole sausages in his plate of stovies. She had watched him hand his plate back to Lizzie and ask for more. So how could she tell her wee granny she felt lucky to have him? It was common knowledge that he'd winched dozens of girls while she'd been sharing a bedroom with her 2 brothers. Donald Jr. didn't have to pay digs into his mother. He didn't have to feel grateful or guilty for anything. Almost as soon as they had met, he had been trying to separate her from her virginity. Catherine had lectured him in the First Communion, and he had guffawed when she earnestly said she was waiting for marriage. He was Shug's nephew right enough. She dug her nails deep into the palm of her hand and chastely turned him down. Secretly, she liked this rare imbalance of power, though part of her had assumed he would dump her for it. Yet somehow, Donald Jr. never turned back. Instead, he spoke to his uncle Shug, and on her 17th, he proposed to her, his step-cousin, on the top deck of a Trongate bus in a showy scene that was more about him than it ever was about her. As the rain fell harder, Catherine started into a small trot in the high boots. There had been all kinds of lurid stories splashed in black and red across the front of the evening papers, with photo booth pictures of young women who had been raped and murdered in the shadows of the city. The papers said they were prostitutes and published biased stories about the drug problems they had to feed. One of the young girls had been strangled and dumped in a shallow burn by the edge of the motorway. The killer had folded her abused body neatly and slipped her inside a black bin bag. She had lain there for months until some fly-tippers had burst the bag and her purple hand slid out. In all that time, no one had reported her missing. It made Wally suck at his dentures in pity, and Lizzie asked where the chapel was in all this. Catherine had studied the newspaper photos of the dead girls with horror. Their hollow cheeks and sunken eyes were stark against the photo booth portraits with their blanching orange background. A murdered young girl, and the best photo her family could provide was the extra copies she had done for her monthly transit pass. It wasn't yet dark when she reached the concrete forecourt of the tower block. In the gloaming, there were several young Waynes standing in a circle and poking something with a stick. The Waynes were too young to be out this late, and some had no coats or shoes on in the July rain. Something in the damp pile caught her attention. Something familiar, but out of place. Catherine crossed the forecourt and hoped it wasn't a dead dog again. Someone had been rat poisoning all the Sighthill strays. They had thought that kinder than watching them writhe in heat. On the ground lay a wet heap of smouldering curtains, purple paisley that she recognised to be the same as her mother's, burnt and still smoking. Counting in twos, she found the 16th floor and saw that all the lights were on and the windows were flung open at this late hour. It was not a good sign. Chances were that her brother Leek wouldn't be home. If the night had gone as she expected, he would have seen it coming at dinner and sloped off and hid. He was good at that. Being quiet, nobody missed him much. But she had to find him. She couldn't face their mother alone. There was a dark alley with the iron railings of St. Stephen's on the right and the chain-link fence of Springburn Pallet Works on the left. It was known as a dangerous walk. Once you had started down the path, there was no turning back till you reached the far end. Gangs loved it. About halfway down the alley, an old drunk couple was staggering through the wind-blown rubbish. Catherine could hear the woman whispering dirty promises to the old man. She hurried along and then dipped down and crawled under a gap in the chain-link fence. The fence caught the back of her hair, and for a panicked moment, she thought they had a hold of her. Catherine pulled, the hair ripped, and as she freed herself, she fell backwards into the mud. Wet and scalped, she watched her hair hanging there like animal fur and thought about the way she could take it out on Leek. Inside the pallet factory, there were thousands of stacked cubes made up of blue shipping crates. Each cube stood around 30 feet tall and was as wide as the foundation of any tower block. The foreman had arranged them like tenemented streets, 10 blocks wide by 10 blocks deep, set with just enough space in between to move a little pallet truck up the aisles. She counted the way as Leek had grudgingly taught her. It would have been easy to get lost amongst the pallets in the daytime and was much easier in the dark. Spotlights mounted on the side of the warehouse cast a weak glow down the north-south lines of pallet cubes, but turn a corner, and it was instantly as black as night. By the time she noticed the orange embers dancing in the dark, it was too late. She tried to turn, but the wet heels of her suede boots slipped, and she slid further into the darkness. Hard hands grabbed her arms and pulled her towards the swarm of fireflies. She made to scream, but a hand closed over her mouth. She could taste the nicotine and glue that lingered on the fingers. Many hands moved onto her body, roaming and searching. There was a swishing sound of corduroy as a pair of legs moved closer behind her. The legs pressed into her, and she could feel the man through the thinness of his tight trousers. He was bloating with blood and excitement. One of the burning embers came closer and glowed ominously in front of her face. "The fuck do you want?" it asked.
"It's got nice tits," said the embers to her left.
All the burning fireflies laughed and danced.
"Gives a feel."
She felt a small hand, almost like a woman's, pull at her work blouse. A silver light cut through the darkness, and Catherine felt cold metal press against the side of her face. The dirty hand over her face moved down to her throat. The silver fishing knife touched the side of her mouth and pushed inside a little. It tasted metallic, like a dirty spoon.
"Selica Rangers."
Catherine let out a sad whine.
It was an impossible question. If she answered wrong, the blade would leave her with a Glasgow smile, a scar from ear to ear, a marking for life. If she answered right, she might just get raped. Many nights, Catherine had sat up in bed, brushing her long hair, and watched Leek ask the same nonsense of Shuggy. Leek would straddle his baby brother with his lanky limbs and pin him to the floor. He would make two fists, holding them inches from Shuggy's face, and would ask, "Cemetery or hospital?" It was pointless. All answers gave the same result. You were going to get whatever the bad bastard on top of you wanted to give. "I'm not going to ask you again." The gutting knife rattled against her teeth as it tested the inside of her cheek. A single tear escaped her left eye. Catherine thought of the gluey fingers and forced a guess.
"Celtic?"
The man huffed in disappointment. "Lucky answer." He drew the knife out slowly from between her lips. He was enjoying the terror on her face. Catherine put a finger inside her cheek, tasting the warm, salty tang of blood, but the skin was still blessedly together. A bright light shone directly into her face, and she shrank back against the man behind her.
"Fuck me," said the voice. "It's wee Leek's sister."
It took a moment for her eyes to adjust to the torchlight. She put her hand on the tip and angled it down to the ground. The men standing around her were only boys, younger than her, and probably younger than Leek. They had been smoking and waiting in the dark. With no peace at home, they were waiting for someone to molest or for a chance to knife the night watchman. Her hand shot out and connected with the owner of the silver knife. She felt no better, so she made another fist and rained it down on his neck, head and shoulders. The boy covered his head and danced away, laughing. Catherine pushed through the boys in disgust and ran the last block of pallets. She could hear feet, fast and flat, behind her. She grasped the wall of rough blue wood, and as quick as she could, she hauled herself up the stack of pallets. Behind her, she felt a hand wrap around one of her new boots. It gave a quick tug, and her foot came free from its ledge. It took all of her strength to hold on to the splintery wood. She swung her boot back and heard it crack off a thick skull bone. And lifting her knee, she found some purchase and scrambled up the rest of the tower. The torchlight shone up her skirt, trying to illuminate her gusset. They were taunting her, their voices pitched, ready to break. The dangerous sound of little boys coming into the intoxicating power of manhood. She pulled herself the last 10 feet to the top. She wanted to lie down for a moment and catch her breath, but she forced herself to stand up and look defiantly over the side. There were 5 of them, pockmarked and fuzzy-faced. They were grinning up at her, as the eldest was pushing his forefinger into a donut hole he had made with his other hand. Catherine spat over the side onto them. It was a wide shower of white foam, and the boys shrieked like the children they still were and scattered like laughing rats. Standing on top of the flat pallet stack, she looked over the uniform fields of bright blue wood. The boys had made her lose count, and she hoped she had climbed the right tower. Leek could leap the 8 feet or so between the stacks, but she never could. In wet boots, she would slip and fall to the ground. She shuddered to think what the Neds would do to her body as she lay there with a broken neck. Catherine counted 4 from the fence and counted 5 from the turning. It was right. She hadn't lost count. Searching the top of the stack, she decided on a pallet that was about 4x4 in from the southeast corner. Checking over her shoulder, as she had been taught, she bent over and lifted a blue pallet free from the rest. A flickering light shone from somewhere within. Catherine put her head into the opening and hissed her brother's name in the direction of the faint light.
"Leek! Leek!"
There was no answer. She hissed again, and suddenly the flickering light was snuffed, and it went dark in the hole. Rain dripped from the end of her nose as she peered closer into the void. Suddenly, a white face with small pink ears shot up at her from the darkness.
Boo!
Catherine fell backwards. If she had been closer to the edge, she would have fallen over the side. She hocked a wad of spittle into Leek's white face.
Aw, fuck's sake!
Well, what the fuck did you try to scare me like that for?
Catherine pulled her knees together and searched her red hands for blue splinters. The fear and shame flooded her then, and her face was awash in frustrated tears. Leek wiped his mouth with his jumper sleeve. He misunderstood her weeping.
Don't start greeting about it. You coming in or what? You're letting the rain in.
Catherine sulked over to the opening and climbed down into her brother's den. Leek pulled the loose pallet closed over their heads. Inside, it was as musty as an open grave and dark as a closed coffin. Catherine no sooner began the low exhale that preceded her moaning than Leek warned her,
"What's your wished?"
as he shuffled about in the pitch blackness. In the farthest corner, there was a clinking of metal, and the space lit up with a faint, smoky light. The camping lamp threw long shadows around the cave-like space. The centre of the hollowed-out pallets was easily twice the size of their bedroom at home, but the ceiling was only about 6 feet high. Leek had covered the floor and the walls in old bits of discarded carpet and flattened cardboard boxes. Through the narrow hole in the top, he had dragged old bits of furniture and broken kitchen chairs. The pallets had been arranged to make supporting columns, and some had been angled and covered with old rugs to make a type of hard-looking settee. On the carpeted walls were naked pictures of Page Three girls. Someone had put up a picture of Maggie Thatcher, and another joker had drawn a veined cock going into her haranguing mouth. Catherine watched her brother go about making his home comfortable for her. She had known some of the older Sightonhill boys who had hollowed it out a few years before. After the wildest of them had stabbed a nosy night watchman, they had been left pretty much alone. It was a great place to get drunk and sniff bags of glue. Most of the younger boys just liked that it was a space free from their heavy-handed fathers. Some of the boys brought girls here and would make beds out of borrowed coats and jumpers. Slowly, as good reputations became ruined, the Sighthill girls stopped coming to the pallet den. The boys' voices kept breaking and their hormones kept raging, so most of them skulked away in randy pursuit. The pallet house became emptier and quieter. Now Leek could often spend the entire weekend there alone. If Agnes would take a drink on a Thursday, then Leek would take some tins of beans and powdered custard from his granny's kitchen and come here to hide. When he'd come back on a Sunday night, they would all be watching the television. Agnes would be soft and repentant, the demon drink having left her. She would make a cuddling space on the settee next to her, and he would sit close, enjoying the warm, perfumed smell of her bath. Lizzie would look at him with a distant smile and ask him if he'd been in his bed all weekend. It was good to be a quiet soul. Not that he was small. By the time he turned 15, he was already over 6 feet tall. He had always been skinny, and as he grew, he became even more thrifty and efficient in build. His hair, like his build, he had inherited from his long-forgotten real father. It was fine and wispy, mouse brown in colour, and hung softly over his ears and eyes. His eyes were grey and clear, but always slow to show emotion. He had long perfected the art of staring through people, leaving conversations to follow his daydreams through the back of their heads and out any open window. Leek was as economical with his emotions as he was spare in build. From his real father, he had inherited a gentle personality, quiet and pensive, lonesome and far away. His only real physical concession to his mother was his nose, large and bony, too severe to be Roman. It broke the line of his soft, shy fringe and sat upon his thin face like a proud monument to his Irish Catholic ancestors. Agnes, had gotten it from Willie, and Willie had gotten it from his own father, who'd brought it from County Donegal. It left no one unscarred and overlooked no man or woman in the Campbell